56 Mornings on Sports 56 and 98.5 FM. This hour is brought to you by James Gaddis Jewelers.
Genuine diamonds, baby.
Here once again, Greg Gaston and Eli Savoy.
Welcome back in. It's 8:01 here in the Family Leisure Studios. Hour number two, Sports 56 Mornings on this Thursday, June the 4th, 2026. Good to have you with us. If you're just getting up, maybe you didn't stay up last night to watch and you missed it, the Knicks did get game one of the NBA Finals, 105-95 over the San Antonio Spurs. Coming up, we're going to talk some NBA draft with Chip Williams. Kerry Miller coming up towards the bottom of the hour to talk a little Major League Baseball. Brandon Marcello on college football coming up next hour as well here on the program. We are in the Family Leisure Studios where family and fun come together. That is Family Leisure. You can check them out for all your backyard needs for summer. Pools, above ground, in ground, great deals right now. Patio furniture, price to move right now as well. How about a five-piece patio furniture set starting at $9.99? Outdoor sectional starting at $12.99 with a free umbrella and base with select patio furniture purchases. Plus, great deals on hot tubs, and spas, swim spas. Mention this ad, get $200 off any pool or spa purchase at Family Leisure. That's at 2120 Witten Road, just north of I-40. Check them out today, or any day is a great day to go see the folks over at Family Leisure. Weather-wise, going to be a very nice day once again with a mixture of sun and clouds. We're currently at 67 degrees, and we're going to high of around 87 today. Again, mixture of sun and clouds. Much more of the same tomorrow as well. And a high tomorrow about 88 degrees. This weekend, it does look like we are going to get some rain. As we're trying to get a hold of Chip right now. Let's see here. I'm trying to do this. Text him while we do this. You sure you have the correct number? No, that's the incorrect number. That's, yep, you had the wrong number. There you go. Now we got the correct number. So we're good. Live radio. We're doing this live on the air. We got this live happening right now in front of you folks. But yes, we are going to get this. Now we got this figured out, and we're going to get Chip taken care of here. Get him on the show in just a moment. This hour of the program is brought to you by James Gaddis Jewelers. You can, of course, check them out in East Memphis for all your jewelry needs. They've been doing it for a very long time. Go see James and the gang at James Gaddis Jewelers. Well, we are less than now 3 weeks away, because on Tuesday was the 3 week point before the NBA draft. So 3 weeks from today, the NBA draft will be complete. And we want to talk a little draft, talk a little bit about the prospects, talk about the Grizzlies and things that they might do with Chip Williams, NBA draft analyst, NBA draft expert, who we've had on the program in the past. Always does a fantastic job. You can follow him on Twitter at Swing Skill. That's at Swing Skill. And Chip joins us now on the program. Hey, Chip, what's going on, buddy?
Oh, not too much, Eli. Appreciate you having me on. Always good to chat some prospects with you this time of year.
I absolutely appreciate you coming on. And with 3 weeks, a little less than 3 weeks to go before the draft, everybody has talked so much about this draft class and how good this class is. Do you believe that this could be a historically good draft class?
I do, especially at the top. I mean, I think it is really special to have the three players you do at the top of the draft with, you know, Boozer, Darren Peterson, and A.J. DeBonta. And then you go even a little bit deeper into the rest of the top 10, top 12, maybe even as high as the top or as late as the top 15. I think you're going to get like all-star level players out of that group and big-time starting playoff level players. It's really a good crop at the top of this draft. I think that it's lost some of its depth as you get later in the draft. Just, I think this is the new reality of the way the draft is going to work in the NIL era, where it's going to be elite freshmen, guys without any more college eligibility, a couple internationals, and then a couple of sophomores and juniors who decide it's time to leave school. And everybody else is going to go back to school. So it's lost a little bit of depth, but yeah, this is a big time draft. What people are saying is true. And it's very fortunate that the Grizzlies were able to jump up into that top three to secure one of these guys.
So you mentioned the three guys at the top. You do not include Caleb Wilson in there to make it kind of a big four?
I think Wilson is interesting. I think he's like a half tier below those top three guys, and then maybe like a half tier above everybody else. I have a couple questions. Like, you know, I've heard the comparisons with him with like Kevin Garnett or even Jaren Jackson, and I think that misses the mark for me. One thing with Wilson is that he looks like he should be a great rim protector, but he's really not. The block numbers at North Carolina were a lot lower than a lot of the guys who've gone on to be elite rim protectors at that type of mold, like Evan Mobley, Jaren Jackson, who we mentioned. So I think the defense, he's good, like in space, he can switch, he moves his feet pretty well. But my concern is that, all right, he doesn't shoot threes, and he's not a primary rim protector. So that just kind of limits and makes it a little bit narrower building a team around Wilson, because you have to cover for those deficiencies. Now, I think it's very possible that he does shoot threes at some point, because he's got really good touch on his mid-range jumper. Mm-hmm. But just projecting that now, it's a whole lot easier, Eli, to be, if you want to be good at something in the NBA, to just go ahead and be good at it before you get to the NBA. Yeah. Trying to develop stuff against other professionals is difficult. So that it's just those questions that I have with Wilson that maybe I don't have as many with the other three.
So with those other three guys, ignoring everything else, just how would you rank the other three guys, 1, 2, 3?
Yeah, this has been hard, frankly. This class has been very hard to kind of sift through, because I think the margins are so thin at the top. And you know, coming into the draft, I went back and looked at my preseason board from this past year, and I had Darren at 1, Boozer at 2, and AJ at 3. And throughout the course of the season, I have maintained that for the most part, but I have flipped Cameron Boozer and Darren Peterson. So my 3 is Boozer at number 1, Peterson very close behind at number 2, and then AJ just a smidge behind Darren at 3.
With Boozer, what kind of give us your, because there's a good chance that he's going to be the guy there sitting there for the Grizzlies if things go as people expect. Why do you like Boozer so much?
You know, it's interesting. And I think that, you know, if we were having this conversation a couple years ago, I'm not sure that I would have had Boozer number 1. But, you know, every year that I do this, I try to, you know, learn from really smart people and learn from my own mistakes and my own successes, and just try to get a deeper understanding of what potential is and what upside is. And is it the things that we all think it is? And I think that it's not. One thing that I have really come to appreciate is that the more productive that you are at a younger age against higher level competition is really a good indicator that there's untapped potential here and that there's a pretty high ceiling here. And I go back and I look at Cameron Boozer. He won Gatorade Player of the Year when he was 15 years old. So at 15 years old, this guy was considered the best high school basketball player in America. And then all he did was he went on the most difficult shoe circuit, EYBL, and he won Peach Jam at 15U, 16U, and 17U. And then he goes to college as maybe the most decorated high school player in the modern era, and someone who has been tracked very heavily with a lot of data and film points since he was about 14 years old, comes to college, puts up one of the most productive seasons that an 18-year-old has ever had in the NCAA, specifically in the modern era, wins National Player of the Year, is frankly an incredible shot from Braylon Mullins from making the Final Four and leading a Duke team that was okay, but I think a notch below Duke standards. If you look at this draft, I mean, it's really Boozer at the top from that Duke class, and everybody else is a little bit further down. So I just think that, you know, when we assess potential and upside, I think we often think about, okay, well, does he jump high? Does he run fast? Does he move his feet well? And maybe if he's not good at basketball, then we can just project him to get better. But what if a guy is just already one of the smartest, strongest, best basketball players and has dominated every age class that he's been in for the last 4 years? Why would I change my opinion and think, okay, well, when he gets to the NBA, all of a sudden, it's just going to not work anymore? I just think that there is this level of understanding and processing that he brings, coupled with this really strong, sturdy frame that allows him to get anywhere on the floor that he wants. And I think it's going to work. I think that you go back and look at some of the high school stuff, he was operating more as an initiator, as a wing. And I think he bulked up quite a bit at Duke to help play some of the center minutes, because Patrick Ngongba for them was injury prone, and really Malik Brown was the only other center on that roster. So Boozer put on quite a bit of weight before he got to Duke. And I think it's low-hanging fruit for him to drop 10 or 15 pounds, transition into more of a perimeter-oriented forward, and build around that in the NBA.
So the one thing that I've brought up with the only really, again, I think the Grizzlies can't miss, quite frankly, at number three. I just think they're, it doesn't matter. You just take whichever one's left and you're fine. Boozer alongside Zach Edey, pairing those two together, little slow foot speed with both of them. How do you think that pairing works?
No, it's a valid point. And, you know, I think that from an offensive perspective, I think it fits very well. You look at kind of what Boozer's able to do when he's just kind of this creation hub when you get him the ball. He figures it out. He is so smart at being able to punish double teams, punish teams for over-rotating, finding the open man. And then the trouble is, if you just single guard him, he's likely going to be stronger and smarter than the player guarding him, and he's going to figure out a way to get a quality shot. So I think, like, going back to what he did at Duke, he played with Ngongba very well and was able to really operate a high-low situation with him. But I think that a play finisher like Zach Edey's caliber is just going to have an absolute field day playing off of Cam Boozer offensively. Defensively, it is certainly a question. I think that there are real questions about who Boozer guards in the NBA. I don't think he's a bad defender by any means. I think he's a pretty smart defender, and he's got some good length and size to be able to guard up. But when you compare what he and Edey are able, you know, what some of their deficiencies, it is fair. Like, I think that the Grizzlies are going to have to figure that part out and put some quality athleticism around those guys. But, you know, I think we've seen, too, with Edey, going back to his Purdue days, he was essentially asked to not be a shot blocker in order to stay out of foul trouble so that he could stay on the court as much as possible. And in the NBA, we've seen a little bit more of the rim protection. And as long as he's not having to chase a bunch of guys, you know, for example, like a Karl Anthony Towns, having to chase him around the perimeter, and he can just kind of hang out in the paint, he covers up a lot. And so I think that it can work, but it is certainly a fair question to raise, and something that, you know, Isolo and those guys are going to have to figure out.
So let's pretend the Grizzlies end up with Boozer at number three, and then let's say they want to go the guard route at number 16. Who are some guys maybe that you think would be there around 16 for them amongst the guards that you would take?
Yeah, this is a great year if you want to take a guard in the mid-first round, because there's just so many of them, and they all can't go in the lottery. You know, there's a few names that come to mind. Number one is a guy that's here working out in Memphis with Mike Miller, Abuka Okorie from Stanford. He had one of the most productive seasons scoring-wise for a teenager in NCAA. I mean, he was just absolutely phenomenal. He's explosive athlete. He came in with a really plus wingspan, defends pretty well. And what I like about him, and you can go back and study this, there's, if you look at shooting profiles before guys got to the NBA, typically guys that had a lower assisted rate in terms of were they creating their own shot, or were they just essentially a spot-up shooter or a play finisher, and they were off of a heavy assisted diet? Abuka Okori is almost entirely self-created. So he's taking difficult shots because that's what his team is asking him to do, and he's making them at a high rate. So I really buy the scoring and shooting upside there. Actually, another guy that's here in Memphis but working out with Mike Miller and Lyft is LeBaron Filon from Alabama. Filon was a guy that I thought could have come out last year's draft and been a first-rounder. There were real questions about the scoring. I think the shooting numbers were not as good after his freshman season, so he ultimately comes back to Alabama and shoots the cover off the ball, plays incredible. And if it wasn't for this loaded class, I think would be a lock to go in the top 10. But because of the way that the guard class fell this year, there's a chance LeBaron Filon sitting there for the Grizzlies at 16. Do have some concerns about the frame. He's really skinny, kind of a narrow frame, so I'm not sure how much he can add to that, but really good player. And then I'll give you one more name. One of my personal favorites in the draft is Bennett Sturts. I think that Sturts deserves to be in the conversation with those elite guards at the top of the draft. The production that Sturts had in a very strange context at Iowa, essentially, Eli, they did not play in transition at all. There was no easy buckets for Bennett Sturts. Everything was in the half court. Everything, they were going to run their sets. They were going to get tough shots, and they were going to control the pace of the game. And despite all of that, Sturts is one of the most productive guards in college. And I just think he's so good at operating pick and rolls. When he's got NBA athletes and a more spread out court around him, there's real upside there for him to be a starting level point guard in the NBA.
Talking with Chip Williams here on the Sissy's Log Cabin guest line, NBA draft expert. A couple of other guys just want to get your opinion on. What do you think about Nate Amet and where he will end up going?
You know, he's a tough one because I think you see the tools and you see the shooting ability from a guy that of his size, and you just think, oh, man, this is a high-ceiling player. I was running some there's a great website, Bart Torvik, they do a lot of similar stuff that Ken Palm does, and they have a really nice search tool where you can kind of historically go back and look at the way guys perform statistically and see who also hit those thresholds. And I was looking back to see guys who were Nate Amet's size who struggled to finish at the rim the same way he did. He was under 50% at the rim. He was one of seven players, and the other six guys I'd never heard of, and they never played in the NBA.
Oh, wow.
So that concerns me right off the bat that he's got this great size, but it's not functional. He doesn't use it. I mean, when you're struggling to score half the time at the rim at 6'10", there's something else going on there. But at the same time, he shoots well. He draws a ton of fouls. He's got a really nice mid-range game. There is stuff to work with there. I just get concerned that is it all going to come together? I think he's got a lot of work to do on his body. He's got to add some core strength and some lower body strength and add some mass to his frame, which, to his credit, he was listed at 185 coming out of high school. He measured in at 211 pounds at the combine. So he put on 26 pounds, if my math's right there. Yeah. 26 pounds during his time at Tennessee, which is a great signal. So I like Amet maybe in the back half of the lottery or mid-first round, but it seems like he's going to go in the top 10 and maybe as high as 6 to the Nets.
Yeah, I think when you just look at those raw numbers, people fall in love with that length and everything else and a guy who could shoot it. Where do you fall on Adai Mara?
Yeah, I really like Mara. I think the big concern with me is that he just didn't play a whole lot of minutes in college at all. Like he barely played at UCLA, and then he comes to Michigan, has a tremendous season, but he still was only able to play, I think he was around 25 minutes a game. So I think on a per minute basis, he's one of the more impactful players in this draft. But if I'm spending a top 5, 6, 7 pick on a guy and he's going to be capped as mid-20s minute player, that is a bit concerning. But I think everything else, like the defense is really good. He's despite kind of the way he looks, he's a really good mover for that size. And I also think he's just such a smart player. Some of the passes that he's able to access in the half court is just so impressive for a guy like that. Finishes everything at the rim. I don't think he's ever going to be a shooter. But at the same time, you know, Donovan Clingan now shoots a little bit in the NBA, and I would have never thought he could do that. So maybe. But, yeah, I think Mar's really good and probably worth a top 10 pick. Just that the minutes thing is the one thing I'll really point to and say, what's going on there? Is it a conditioning thing? Is it a long-term maintenance thing? Just that would be my one question and try to dive into the background.
Do you have Acuff as the top of that group of point guards or somebody else? And do you think with what Jalen Brunson continues to do, does that help Darius Acuff in NBA scout, you know, these GM's eyes?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it helps all these small guards. You know, I think that at some level we have to recognize that Darius Acuff, excuse me, that Jalen Brunson is an outlier, and that he's, you know, we can't just say that, okay, well, every guard who's 6 feet or 6 foot one is great because Jalen Brunson's maybe going to lead the Knicks to an NBA title. But yeah, I do think that it does prove the case that you don't have to be, you know, SGA size to be a point guard in the NBA. You can be smaller and make it work. But I think you look at like what Brunson does, he's so on balance. He's really got some beef, kind of a stocky guy, hard to bump off his spot, and then just unbelievable shooting touch. And so I look at a guy like Darius Acuff, and I think, all right, well, the frame's pretty similar. I mean, this guy's got some real mass to him and is able to absorb the contact similar to Brunson. And he also had an incredible shooting season at Arkansas. And, yeah, I mean, I think those comparisons are natural and understandable. I personally have Michael Brown Jr. from Louisville as the top point guard in the class. I just think the combination of size, the amount of three-pointers that he shot, the vertical athleticism, the handle, I think he is the most creative passer out of that group as well. The back concerns are obviously very real, and, you know, that's one thing that NBA teams have over a guy like me. I don't have access to medicals, so I can't tell you what the long-term prognosis is there, but I think that Michael, just the combination of functional athleticism, the amount of threes that he gets up, and the passing is really the separator. But, I mean, we are really splitting hairs with these guys. It is a difficult group to sift through.
See, that's – I've said all along, I've always liked Michael Brown because of the size. There's a back issue that, yes, I would stay away when you've got these other options that you've got. But I really like Brown a lot. Would I be disappointed in Acuff? No, like I don't think you'd ever be disappointed in Acuff either. What about Wagler? Because he's a guy that came out of nowhere and had this great year, but nobody going into the year was looking at this guy as a top 10 draft pick. Is that a concerning thing at all, like that he wasn't that highly rated, or what do you think of him?
Yeah, it's notable at the very least that, you know, he was not a very highly ranked recruit. And you know, these days with the amount of access we have to stats and film, it's much rarer that guys slip through the cracks than it used to be. But it does happen, and it seems to have happened with Keaton Wagler. Although he didn't slip that far, right? Because Illinois is a really good team, and they identified him. But, yeah, I mean, the combination of size, handle, and shot-making is really tantalizing. If there's a big concern, and I don't think I'm breaking news to anybody, it's that the athleticism, at least from a verticality standpoint, is just not there. I mean, he didn't dunk a single time, and he's 6'6". That's just... It's not, you know, a disqualifier for him being a prospect, but it is very notable that a guy of his size was unable to dunk one time in an NCAA game all year. But, yeah, he's got this funk to him where kind of long, swooping handle, covers a ton of ground on his step backs. Just he figures out how to create separation. And I think when guys have an old man-type game like that, you tend to think, oh, well, there's not much upside there. I actually disagree. This guy is very smart and understands his own game and how to adjust his game to get around superior athletes. And when he can figure that out and be that productive, then, yeah, I'm going to bet on that as a top 10 player in this draft.
He is Chip Williams. You can follow him on Twitter at Swing Skill. Great stuff and breaking down these prospects and NBA draft stuff. Chip, thank you so much for your time, and hopefully we can get you on again before the draft here in a few weeks.
Sounds great. Anytime, Eli. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Chip Williams joining us here on the program. So he has Caleb Wilson in a little slightly different tier than the top three.
Right.
Which, again, although I've said, like, I have probably a slight lean towards Wilson over Boozer. You know, I am never going to complain about either one of the two of them if the Grizzlies were to draft them. I do believe that if Boozer is there, he will be the Grizzlies pick. Yeah, right. I don't believe they would pick Wilson over him. And again, Boozer, the Boozer next to Edie thing, like, just certainly, as he said, I think on the offensive end, absolutely works.
Oh, it becomes, it's like wizard work that you could do with those.
Defensive end, again, I do have a little bit of concern, but I will say this. You should get every rebound.
especially if you have the athletes, like you mentioned, you put the athletes around them and the whole deal. I think it can be cool.
Cedric Coward, Cameron Boozer, Zach Edey on the floor, you should be an unbelievable rebounding team.
It's a 50-plus rebound team a night.
You should dominate the boards if those three guys are out there together. Great stuff from Chip. He's always fantastic at breaking down these prospects. Up next, we shift gears. We talk a little baseball with our friend Kerry Miller from Bleacher Report. That's next here on Sports 56 Mornings on Sports 56 and 98.5 FM.
Let Bryant Dacus and Brett Norsworthy take you home every afternoon. Sports Time on Sports 56. Weekdays from 3 to 6 here on Sports 56 and 98.5 FM.
Now, back to Sports 56 Morning.
Isn't it a lovely morning?
On Sports 56 and 98.5 FM. This hour brought to you by James Gattis Jewelers. Here once again, Greg Gaston and Eli Savoy.
The time here in the Family Leisure Studios on this Thursday morning. Beautiful morning out there. Going to be another nice day here in the Mid-South. A couple of nice days here before some rain. Looks like it could be coming in over the weekend. Time now to talk a little baseball with Kerry Miller.
It's time to talk some baseball. Joining Greg and Eli is Kerry Miller from the Bleacher Report. Here's Kerry with Greg and Eli.
He joins us every week talking baseball. Of course, during the winter months, we're talking college basketball with him. He is Kerry Miller from Bleacher Report. You can follow him on Twitter at Kerrence James. And Kerry, I saw you on Twitter, and it was funny because when I saw this news, I actually thought about you. They announced that the Duke-Michigan basketball game for next year that was going to be played at Madison Square Garden is going to be played at the Miami Marlins Stadium. So it combines your worlds together perfectly.
It combines my worlds. It does. I forget who it was that tweeted, like, this is like moving from Rome to Damascus or something like that. Like, why would you go from the best possible venue in basketball, in frankly any sport,
yes,
to the Marlins Stadium? it's a joke. Yeah. I mean, it was made for me, and I don't even want to go to it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's the other side. Like, I was also like, what? Like, why? What? Why are we putting a basketball game in a baseball stadium? And if all baseball stadiums, why Marlins Stadium?
I don't know. I mean, at least it's not on a, you know, an airline ship or whatever the heck they used to do on the tankers and the playing in. I know they played games like in Germany and stuff and whatever. Finding ways to do things that are interesting. I appreciate the notion of trying things, but this is not something that anybody is asking for outside of maybe, you know, Marlins ownership.
Yeah, and again, especially doing it by leaving Madison Square Garden. Like, I mean, if you've got a game in Madison Square Garden, play the damn game in Madison Square Garden. It's Madison Square Garden, for God's sake. Don't ever mess with that. All right. Can you give me any reason why I shouldn't just give up on my Cubs at this point?
Yeah, it's gotten pretty ugly. I mean, plenty of bats, right? They could they could do kind of what my Nats are doing and just kind of score their way through all these pitching woes, and at least they have some pitching that Washington definitely does not have. But, man, they're just falling apart at the seams. You know, it seems like every day, any sort of news we get on Justin Steele is never good.
Yeah.
It's not like he's coming back anytime soon. There's still waiting on Matt Boyd to come back from his bizarre injury. Cade Horton's gone. There's not much cause for optimism these days, even with the possibility of making a big trade at the deadline. You almost have to hope at this point that the Tigers do throw in the towel real soon and start taking offers on Tarik Skubal.
Well, and the thing too is, if you look at the lineup, the names are, but they can't get a hit with a man in scoring position to save their lives. Dansby Swanson is hitting 183. I don't know at what point you just, can you keep trotting a guy out there hitting 183?
See, that's exactly what everyone was worried about. I mean, not specifically with Dansby Swanson, but, 3-4 years ago when Trey Turner and Xander Bogaerts and I forget who the other one was. It was or Carlos Correa, obviously. Now he's all banged up. But all these guys, it was like, well, all the history says, once second baseman and shortstops reach like 32, 33, they start falling apart in a hurry. Now, I didn't expect Dansby Swanson to have like a Tim Anderson level fall from grace here, but at least he's still playing great defense. Like, he's still providing value, but man, you can't live with that 183 batting average, especially when, Pete Crow Armstrong's come around at the plate, but for a while he was doing the same thing in center field where it's like, he's got a great wins above replacement, but it's, all on the defensive side of things.
Yeah, it's depressing right now, quite frankly, to be a Cub. Although every time they do, they keep setting records. Now they're the only team that with a 15-game home winning streak to follow that up with an 8-game home losing streak. They have the two 10-game winning streaks and a 10-game losing streak, only the second team to do that. So at least they are historical in the things that they do.
I love stupid baseball stats like that. It's what makes the sport so great. But yeah, I forget which article it was I was writing and had the Cubs in there mentioned that they are, in terms of baseball reference wins above replacement, their batters, their position players, second only to the Dodgers, pitching second to last, only ahead of the Giants. So that's where they're at right now.
Man, it is something else. You did do an article giving first the grades to the teams.
That may have been that article.
who'd you give the highest grade to?
I know the Rays had the highest score. They were an A+. Where's my list? I have it here somewhere. There it is. The Braves, Rays, and White Sox all got A+. Brewers, Cardinals, and Nationals, though they have since lost 3 in a row to the Marlins, they were A at the time.
I mean, it's now the Rays have come back down a little bit here. They're slowing down a little bit, but man, again, it's hard to argue at that, certainly. And the White Sox again. I mean, with what, and now they've got the injury with, and we'll see if they're able to withstand that. But I mean, certainly these teams that or a team like the White Sox, as bad as they were last year, to be where they are right now is incredible.
Yeah. So those grades were based solely on what their current winning percentage is compared to what their preseason win total was. So, like, the Rays and White Sox are, like, way ahead of expectations. Even the Braves at whatever they are, 41-20 or something. Like, nobody – they were supposed to be third in the NL East, let alone, first in the majors. So they're drastically exceeding expectations. But, I agree with your concerns on the Rays that it feels like they're coming back to earth. I mean, that was kind of our fear with them all along. Like, they weren't supposed to be anywhere near as good as they have been out of the gates. And they were, like, their run differential suggested they were not as good as their record did. Yeah. But now we're starting to, like, get some concerns that, okay, they only have 3 batters that you can trust at all. And, are they going to be able to continue to carry that offense? Is Nick Martinez really going to be an AL Cy Young guy? Is Shane McClanahan really going to stay healthy? Like, we're starting to see the cracks in the armor that we were worried about before the season began. But they still have the best record in the American League, I believe.
We've talked about this the last couple of weeks, but did you ever think that you could see a pitcher in a month throw 38 1/3 innings, give up 1 run, go 5-0, strike out 57 and walk 6, and not be the pitcher of the month.
It's ridiculous. I assume that was Mizorowski.
That's Mizorowski's
numbers. Sanchez got the pitcher of the month. Meanwhile, right, Shohei Ohtani, who seems to always pitch on Wednesdays. We talk about Shohei like every
I was thinking that today. I was like, I swear every Thursday we go, yep, Shohei did it again last night.
Yeah, lowered his ERA to 0.74 while increasing his batting average to 300. The guy's pretty good. And every time I do like an MVP article, people are like, well, how can you keep putting Ohtani there? How can I not?
Yes. What, like,
who else is going to win that thing?
It's impossible. Like, it's, I mean, again, he's got a 0.74 earned run average and he's batting 300. You can't be more valuable.
Right. When the Dodgers signed him, we were like, well, we'll see if he ever pitches again. And here he is, like 0.74 ERA. It's unreal what that guy is doing. And unfortunately for the 29 other fan bases around the country, the Dodgers have really come on strong, and they're still nowhere near their ceiling, right? They're still waiting on Blake Snell and Tyler Glass now to get healthy. They're still waiting on Mookie Betts to do Mookie Betts things, and still they're like, whatever, 40 and 20-something.
Talking with Kerry Miller on the Sissy's Log Cabin guest line, the National League, you've got now the Braves with a 9.5-game lead, even though the Phillies have been great since Don Mattingly took over. You've got the Brewers with a 5.5-game lead and the Dodgers with a 7-game lead. Are we going to get a race in the National League?
Yeah, I mean, the National League West race got ugly in a hurry. I mean, the Padres were in first place like 3 weeks ago, and now they've also come back to earth, even though Tatis is finally hitting. Kind of weird, like they were great while all of their high-paid stars were struggling. Now that at least one of them is starting to do well, they can't win a game to save their lives. But we expected that in the West, right? The Dodgers were supposed to win that division by a landslide. We'll see about the Brewers. Over the last decade, it feels stupid to ever question them, but I don't know if they necessarily have the offense. I don't know that I believe that Kyle Harrison is the second coming of Paul Skeens and Tarek Skubal, but he's been unbelievable for them alongside Mizorowski. So for them to have that 1-2 punch, it's just so tough. But if, you know, whether or not they're able to keep it up, we'll see. Can the Pirates come back? I don't know. I don't think anybody, I know you're in the St. Louis market, generally speaking. I don't know that anybody necessarily believes that they're in it for the long haul. I'll be interested to see what they decide to do at the trade deadline, because they're in about the same boat they were last year at this time.
You mentioned Tatis, and he finally did at least hit a home run. Are there any like theories out there of like what's wrong, like why he's not producing any power?
No, I mean, he still, so when I was looking at it, he still had phenomenal, like I think he was, had the highest hard hit percentage in the majors. Like he was
really
still smashing the ball, just his launch angle was broken. Like he was hitting, I think of, it was like 230 qualified hitters. He had the third lowest launch angle, and the other two were Chandler Simpson, who bunts a lot, and Justin Crawford, who's like tries to be Ichiro Suzuki with the way he does slap hits the opposite way. So it was just this bizarre thing. But Bryce Harper went through that 2022-23, I forget what it is, for like the first 4 months, he just could not homer to save his life. And then all of a sudden, he like fixed his launch angle and started crushing in August and September. So we've just been kind of like waiting on Tatis to like lock his swing back in. And I don't know what the Padres, I don't even know who the Padres hitting coach is. I should probably know that. But for them to still have that person employed when Tatis couldn't get his launch angle right, when Machado was hitting as poorly as he is, I don't know why they cannot score runs.
Yeah, it's and it certainly didn't work for Nick Castellanos there either.
No,
the salvage project there did not go well. Rob Manfred says that the luxury tax system has failed. Do you believe it has failed?
Man, I don't know. We're just going to hear so many conflicting and flammable reports from both sides of this MLB, MLPA debate for the next few months. I don't know. I was, for the first, until we started hearing about it like day after day, I was kind of forgetting about it, maybe willingly doing so.
Yes,
and feeling good about that we might have a season next year. But man, it is getting pretty ugly in those discussions already.
Do you think that the owners are, like, this is the one they are just dead set that there has to be a cap. Like, will they, you think they would be willing to hold out and say, like, this, we are just, we will not agree to anything that doesn't have a cap?
I think they will for a while. I think the players will be more dug in on it. I think if there is an extended lockout of any sort, I think it's going to be that eventually the owners cave, because I can't imagine a scenario where the players are okay with it. And this is like the number one thing about, you know, baseball and the MLBPA. Like, they'll cave on other things to make sure there is no cap.
And the thing too about, and this seems to happen all the time in the baseball negotiations, like, it feels like in baseball, when we get to this, like, the two sides, like, it's almost like they're accusing the other side of, like, lying and fudge. Like, yeah. It's not like, hey, we want this and they won't give it to us. It's like, oh, they're just, like, blatantly lying and fudging the numbers to make it look better.
Yeah. So you get those reports that, like, last season MLB, the 30 teams took, like, a $1.8 billion loss or whatever. But he was like, okay, well, open the books and let us see that, because you're just like, those are tax write-offs and stuff for you guys. Yes. Like, there's no way, as popular as the game has been the last couple of years, that things are getting worse for you financially. Also, the Padres just sold for $3.9 billion. So which one is it, guys? So yeah. I think that's where we're at, that it's just, you know, you have that, and then you have all the stuff that, you know, happened with Tony Clark as the you know, MLBPA leader for they're just, like, finding ways to throw each other under the bus. So it's not a very, complimentary negotiation process, we'll put it that way.
And that's the thing, too, that the owners, like, anything the owners say, really in any of these sports, like, they never take into consideration how much the value of their franchise has increased from when they bought it. For most of these guys, like, obviously, if you just bought one, it's different. But, like, if you've owned any franchise in any sport for more than, like, 10, 15 years, your return on investment is insane.
Yeah, Jerry Reinsdorf bought the White Sox for, like, a handshake and a couple bucks back in the 1980s, and now he could sell that for probably $4 billion as well. So, yeah, they're definitely not hurting for money. I have seen some people saying, like, you know, when the lockout happened in 94, there was this element of, well, what do we do now? Like, fans didn't have any other options. People might not come back this time around. Like, there are other things you can do than watch baseball over the summer. So that's the big concern, that certainly both sides of this dispute, they agree on that a lockout would be very bad for the sport.
And you can't rely on some steroid fueled home run chase to try and bring people back this time.
I mean, you can. we'll see what they do.
I guess technically, theoretically, you could. Absolutely. He is Kerry Miller. He covers Major League Baseball. He also covers college basketball for the Bleacher Report. He joins us each and every Thursday. Kerry, as always, thank you. We'll talk to you again next week.
You got it. Take care, Eli.
Kerry Miller joining us. Yeah, my Cubs. It keeps getting worse. Like, they're last night watching the game. They've got the lead. It's like, whatever, 4-2. And I'm like, oh, they'll lose. Like, I'm to that point of, I just assume they're going to lose.
When you get at that point, how do you survive the rest of the season?
It's a very angry survival. It's a very angry. I try not to watch the games because they make me mad. Oh, I mean, two nights ago, they scored a run in the first inning, did not score the rest of the night. Last night, they had four runs, after four innings, did not score the rest of the night. It's just, you know, they give up the run in the top of the 10th, bottom of the 10th. They get the guy to third base with one out. And I'm sitting there watching with some people, and I said, they won't score. And sure enough, I was like, it'll be a strikeout. It'll be strikeout, strikeout. And it was a strikeout. Did they strike out? I don't know what the last out of the game was. No, that last out of the game was a flyout. But it's just like, they get a guy in scoring position and they all turn into me at the plate. Like, they can't, they literally can't make contact with the ball if there's a guy in scoring position. It's, oh gosh.
Again, they went, deal with that going from April to October. I can imagine the agony sometimes.
And they presented so much hope with the winning streaks to now be so terrible. Again, they won 15 in a row at home and now have turned around and lost the next eight. From a 15-game home winning streak to an 8-game home losing streak like that. It's, oh, man, it's tough times. I actually really liked this team coming into the year. Now, again, four of their top five pitchers are hurt. That is a problem.
That's a big problem.
But the offense and inability to drive a man in, like from third base with one out, that's just absolutely drives me insane. We'll take a break, come back, wrap up hour number two right after this here on Sports 56 Mornings, Sports 56 and 98.5 FM.
Add a little fun to your lunch break. Join Johnny Radio for Sports 56 Happy Hour from 11 to 1 every weekday on Sports 56 and 98.5 FM.
Tito's Handmade Vodka is America's favorite vodka for a reason.
Now back to Sports 56 Mornings on Sports 56 and 98.5 FM. This hour is brought to you by James Gattis Jewelers.
To reveal the full spectrum of its dazzling color.
Here once again, Greg Gaston and Eli Savoy.
So, after his performance last night again with Shohei Ohtani, lowering his ERA, six shutout innings, lowers his ERA to .74. He at least now has moved into third in the Cy Young odds in the National League. Christopher Sanchez is +125, Mizorowski's +200. Shohei has overtaken Paul Skeens for the third odds at +550. But in the MVP odds, again, we're talking, it's June 4th. We're still, by all means, fairly early in the season.
Right.
He's a -900 favorite for MVP.
Wow.
Kyle Schwarber, who's having an amazing year, hit another home run last night, is +1,400 as the second best odds. Like, Schwarber leads Major League Baseball in home runs. And it, like, there's like the MVP race is over. It's over. Unless Ohtani gets hurt. Like, that's the only way he's not going to win MVP is if he misses a significant chunk of time. And it probably needs to be like 2 months or something.
Yeah, it would be like months.
Like, it can't be just like, if he misses like 3 weeks,
nah.
So what? Nah. That he can make that up easily. It's, and again, you look at this, like we talk about Victor Wembanyama in the NBA, like how many, especially defensive player of the year, like you look, right. I go, how in the hell is that guy not defensive player of the year every right. year? With Ohtani, it literally is. How in the world would he not be the MVP as long as he is pitching and hitting both? How would he not be the MVP? He is essentially two really good players in one.
Two elite players in one, yeah.
He's a top-of-the-line number one starter and an elite offensive player.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a voter, and especially either way, because people will talk about, well, you can either look at it as most valuable or you can look at it as best player. Well, it doesn't matter how you look at it.
He both.
Yeah.
He qualifies for both.
Because if you're 2-1, first of all, you can't be more valuable than that. You're basically taking one roster space to do great work of two guys. And if you just say, well, I'm not worried about value necessarily, I'm just looking at the best player. Well, again, if you are elite both offensively and pitching, that's impossible to argue against that. Seriously, like, as long as he plays, he will be the MVP, barring serious injury. Or at some point he decides that he's not going to pitch anymore. But again, there's no reason to believe that's going to happen anytime soon because he's incredible right now.
If pitching. He were to ever win a Cy Young, would he not automatically be the top athlete of a generation?
He's the best baseball player of all time. Again, Babe Ruth was unbelievable. Babe Ruth was never this as a pitcher. He didn't do it that long. If he does another 3-4 years of this and is elite in both, it's really not even close. There's not even anybody that you could even come close to making an argument. And yes, then you start. Yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, where do you put him amongst the greats? If you're just talking the GOATs of all time.
Like with athletes in general.
Like if you're just, if you're doing the Mount Rushmore of athletes. Like who, right now, that would be what, Jordan?
Depending upon who you talk to. Brady? I think Jordan would be on unanimous though, pretty much.
Brady probably on that?
For a lot of people, probably Tom Brady. I would think some probably would have Shohei there now.
Because I think in years past, you would have always said probably Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
Because he was just that. But and then.
Then if you want to just spread it out, you got like a Serena Williams and so on and so forth.
Tiger
could fit up on there. Usain Bolt, Michael Phelps. You look at some of the Olympic athletes, Simone Biles going through that as well. It's a lot of ways you could go with it and would not be wrong.
But that's, yeah, I would think that we are getting close to a point where Shohei, it won't even be able to be argued. You would say Shohei is on that without a question. I mean, the guy is what? He's either won the MVP or finished second, what, five straight
years? Or something like that, yep.
He's done it in both leagues. There's nothing left for him to do. And again, he may win 8, 9, 10 MVPs.
How many total wins does he have as a career, for a career?
He went that long stretch there where he didn't pitch because of the injury. Let's see. Let me pull up his...
I remember me and John was like, if he can get to like 100 wins with his batting numbers as well, that's insane.
He is – I love his baseball reference page because you have to scan a yard. Okay, there's those batting. Now I got to go down to his pitching.
You got to go to the pitching part.
He is 45-22 as a pitcher.
Okay.
With a 2.76 earned run average. That's the thing, he doesn't win as many games as he should.
Right.
Especially when he was with the Angels, of course, they were terrible. Right. But, this year, with a .74 earned run average, he's only, and I say only, he's only 6-2. Like, get your .74 earned run average. You think but he's 6-2. And especially when you're playing with an offense, a team that is unbelievably good.
Right.
You would think, gosh, .74 earned run average, you've won every start. You know, his career high, he had the 15-9 year, the one year with the Angels. That's his career high in wins. He went the 3 years in a row with the Angels. He went 9-2, 15-9, then 10-5.
Okay.
And then he didn't pitch in the 24 season. Last year, he only started 14 games. Now he's got 10 starts already this year. 110 career starts right now, 45-22. Again, 2.76 earned run average for his career. So, yeah, if he puts in another 3-4 years of this, and certainly at the plate, you know, he's going to continue to do it. Like, there's no reason to believe whatsoever that he's not going to continue to do it at the plate. So let's see. Yeah, five straight years, he's been either the MVP or second. He's won four, and the 1 year he did not win the MVP, he finished second. That was in the American League. And that year, the year he finished second in MVP, he finished fourth in the Cy Young voting. So if he was, that makes you wonder, like, okay, if he was fourth at Cy Young, how was he not the MVP
top
that
five
year?
In the two most prestigious categories in the game?
Yeah, it is silly, man. But it's every single night he goes out now, you're like, you just don't expect him to give up runs. And then you also expect him to hit home runs and everything else. Unbelievable. All right, hour number two in the books. When we come back, hour number three, we'll get back into the NBA Finals game one from last night. We've got Brandon Marcella going to join us to talk some college football and all the things going on off the field. We'll also get into that hearing a little bit from yesterday. We'll do that to kick off hour number three as well as we continue here on Sports 56 Mornings on Sports 56 and 98.5 FM.
Sports 56 and 98.5 FM. Available locally on your radio dial as well as around the world online at sports56whbq.com. Take us with you everywhere by downloading the Sports 56 app. And at home, just say, "Alexa."